You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 354 by Rudolf Steiner. It's Lectures to the Workmen at the Goetheanum, with the title From Sunspots to Strawberries, 14 Discussions, translated by Gladys Hahn, revised by Matthew Barton. This discussion 5 of 12 July 1924 is entitled Origin and Particular Character of Chinese and Indian Cultures. Rudolf Steiner. Gentlemen, I mentioned our wish to look further into the history that is connected with our present study of the world. You've seen how the human race gradually built itself up out of the rest of nature. It was only when conditions on the earth were such that human beings were able to live upon it, when the earth had died, when it no longer had its own life, that human and animal life could develop in the way I have described. Now we have also seen that in the beginning human life was actually quite different from what it is today and unfolded where the Atlantic Ocean is now. We have to imagine that where the Atlantic Ocean is today there was formerly solid ground. Today we have Asia on the one hand, the Black Sea here, below it Africa, then Russia and Asia itself. On the other hand there is England, Ireland, and over there also America. Formerly, everything in between was land, and here, very little land. Over here in Europe, at that time, there was actually a really huge sea. These countries were all in the sea, and when we come up to the north, Siberia was sea, too. It was still all sea. Below where India is today, the land rose a little above the sea. Thus, we actually have some land there, and land on this side, too. Where today we find the Asian peoples, the inhabitants of the Near East, and those of Europe, there was sea, the land only rising up later. The land, however, went much farther, continuing right on to the Pacific Ocean, where today there are so many islands, Java, Sumatra, and so on. They were all part of the continent that used to be there. All this archipelago. Thus, where the Pacific Ocean now is, there was a great deal of land, with sea between the two land masses. Now, the first peoples we are able to investigate remained in this region, here where the land was preserved. When we look around us in Europe, we can really say 10, 12, or 15,000 years ago the earth, the ground, became sufficiently firm for human beings to dwell upon it. Before that, only marine animals were there, which developed out of the sea, and so on. If at that time you had looked for man, he would have been where the Atlantic Ocean is today. But over there in Asia, in Eastern Asia, there were also human beings more than 10,000 years ago. These people naturally left descendants, and the descendants are very interesting on account of their culture, the most ancient on earth. Today, these are the peoples called the Japanese and Chinese. They are very interesting because they are the last traces, so to say, of the oldest inhabitants of the earth. As you have heard, there was, of course, a much older population on earth that was entirely wiped out. These were the peoples who lived in ancient Atlantis, of whom nothing remains. For even if remains did exist, we would have to dig down into the bed of the Atlantic Ocean to find them. We would have to get down to that bed, a more difficult procedure than people think, and dig there and, in all probability, find nothing. For, as I have said, those people had soft bodies. Their culture, consisting of gestures, was something that one cannot dig out of the ground, because there was nothing that endured. Thus, what was there long before the Japanese and Chinese is not accessible to ordinary science. One must have some knowledge of spiritual science if one wants to make such discoveries. However, what has remained of the Chinese and Japanese peoples is very interesting, You see, the Chinese and the older Japanese, not those of today, about whom I will speak in a moment, the Chinese and Japanese had a culture quite different from ours. We would have a much better idea of it if we Europeans had not in recent centuries extended our domination over those regions, bringing about a complete change. In the case of Japan, this change has been very thorough. Although Japan has kept its name, it has been entirely Europeanized. Its people have gradually absorbed everything from the Europeans, and what remains of their ancient culture is merely its outward form. The Chinese have preserved their identity better, but now they can no longer hold out. It is true that European dominion is not actively established there, but what the Europeans think is becoming all-prevailing. At what once existed there has disappeared. This is no cause for regret. It is in the nature of human evolution. It must, however, be mentioned. Now, if we observe the Chinese, among whom things can be seen in a less adulterated form, we find a culture distinct from all others. For the Chinese did not include in their ancient culture anything that can be called religion. The Chinese culture was devoid of religion. You must picture to yourselves, gentlemen, what is meant by a, quote, culture without religion, close quote. When you consider the cultures that have religion, you find everywhere in the old Indian culture, for instance, veneration for beings who are invisible, but who seem to resemble human beings on earth. It is the peculiar feature of all later religions that they represent their invisible beings as human-like. Anthroposophy does not do this. Anthroposophy does not represent the supersensible world anthropomorphically, but as it actually is. Further, it sees in the stars the expression of the supersensible. The remarkable thing is that the Chinese had something of the same kind. The Chinese do not venerate invisible gods. They say, quote, what is here on earth differs according to climate, according to the nature of the soil where one lives, close quote. You see, China in the most ancient times was already a large country and is still today larger than Europe. It is a gigantic country, has always been gigantic, and has had a tremendously large, vigorous population. Now, the idea that the population of the earth has continually increased is just superstition on the part of modern science, which always bases its calculations on data that suits itself. The truth is that even in the most ancient times, there was a vast population in China, also in South America and North America. There, too, in those ancient times, the land reached out to the Pacific Ocean. If that is taken into account, the population of the earth cannot be said to have grown. So, gentlemen, we find a culture there that is quite ancient, and today this culture can still be observed as it actually existed 10,000, 8,000 years ago. The Chinese said, quote, above in the north, the climate is different, the soil is different from how they are farther south. Everything is different there. The growth of the plants is different, and human beings have to live in a different way. But the sun is all-pervading. The sun shines in the north and in the south. It goes on its way and moves from warm regions to cold regions. Close quote. And they interpreted this as meaning that on earth diversity prevails, but the sun makes everything equal. They saw in the sun a fertilizing, equalizing force. They went on to say, therefore, quote, if we are to have a ruler, our ruler must be like that. Individual people differ, but he must rule over them like the sun, close quote. For this reason, they gave him the name, quote, son of the sun, close quote. And that's S-O-N, son of the sun, S-U-N. Readers aside. His task was to rule on earth as the sun rules in the universe. The individual planets, Venus, Jupiter, and so on, act in their various ways. The sun, as ruler over the planets, unites and equalizes everything. Thus, the Chinese pictured their ruler as a son of the sun. For they took the word sun, S-O-N, essentially to imply belonging to something. Everything was then so arranged that the people said, quote, the sun of the sun is our most important man. The others are his helpers, just as the planets are the helpers of the sun. Close quote, S-U-N. They organized everything on earth in accordance with what appeared above in the stars. All this was done without prayer, for they did not know the meaning of prayer. It was actually all done without their having what later would constitute a cult. What might be called their kingdom was organized so as to be an image of the heavens. It could not yet be called a state. That is a mischief which modern people perpetrate. But they arranged their earthly affairs to be an image of what appeared to them in the stars above. Now, something came about through this circumstance that was naturally quite different from what happened later. Each person became the citizen of a kingdom. He had no creed to profess. He simply felt himself to be a member of a kingdom. Originally, the Chinese had no gods of any kind. When later they did have them, they were gods taken over from the Indians. Originally, they had no gods. But their connection with the supersensible worlds was expressed by the essential nature of their kingdom and its institutions. Their institutions had a family quality. The son of the sun was at the same time father to all the other Chinese, and these served him. Although it was a kingdom, it was something like a family too. All this was only possible for people whose thinking had as yet no resemblance to that of later humanity. The thinking of the Chinese at that time was not at all like that of later human beings. How we think today would have been quite foreign to the Chinese. We think, for example, animal, man, vase, or table. The Chinese did not think in this way, but instead, there is a lion, a tiger, a dog, or a bear, not there is an animal. They knew one neighbor had a table with corners, someone else had a table that was rounder. In other words, they gave names to single things, but what a, in quotes, table is never entered their head. In quotes, table as such, of that they had no knowledge. They could see that someone had a bigger head and longer legs, while someone else had a smaller head with shorter legs, and so on. But, in quotes, man, in general, was to them an unknown term or idea. They thought in quite a different way, in a way impossible for us today. They had need, therefore, of other concepts. Now, if you think table, man, animal, you can extend this to legal matters, for jurisprudence consists solely of such concepts. But the Chinese were unable to think out any legal system. With them, everything was organized as in a family. Within a family, when a son or daughter wants to do something, there is no thought of such a thing as a legal contract. But today, if someone here in Switzerland wants to do something, he consults liability laws, marriage laws, and so on. There one finds all that is needed, and the laws then have to be applied to individual cases. Inasmuch as human beings still retain something of the Chinese in them, and there always remains a little, they don't really feel comfortable about laws and must always have recourse to a lawyer. They are even at sea sometimes with general concepts. As for the Chinese, they never had a legal code. They had nothing at all of what later took on the nature of a state. All they had was what each individual could judge in his individual situation. So, to continue, the whole Chinese language was influenced by this fact. When we say table, we at once picture a flat surface with one, two, or three legs, and so on, but it must be something that can stand up like a table. If anyone were to tell us a chair is a table, we would say, "A table? You ass? That's not a table, that's a chair." And if someone else came along and called the blackboard a table, we'd call him a double ass, for it's not a table at all, but a blackboard. With our language, we have to call each thing by its own special name. That is not so with Chinese. I will put this to you hypothetically. It will not be a precise picture, but you will get the idea from it. Say, then, the Chinese has a certain sound for table. But this same sound signifies many other things, too. Thus, let us say, such a sound might mean tree, brook, also perhaps pebble. Then it has another sound, let's say, that it can mean star, and also blackboard, and, for instance, bench. Parenthesis, these meanings may not be correct in detail. I mean only to show the way the Chinese language is built up, close parenthesis. And now the Chinese person knows there are two sounds here, say L-A-O and B-A-O, each meaning things that are quite different, but also both meaning brook. So he puts them together, Baolao. In this way, he builds up his language. He does not build it up from names given to single things, but according to the various meanings of the various sounds. A sound may mean tree, but it may also mean brook. When, therefore, he combines two sounds, both of which, beside many other things, mean brook, the other man knows that he means brook. But when he utters only one sound, no one knows what he means. In writing, there are the same complications. So the Chinese have an extraordinarily complicated language and an extraordinarily complicated script. And indeed, gentlemen, a great deal follows from this. It follows that for them, it is not so easy to learn to read and write as it is for us, nor even to speak. With us, reading and writing can really be called simple. Indeed, we are unhappy when our children don't quickly learn to read and write. We think it is merely child's play. With the Chinese, this is not so. In China, one grows quite old before one can write or in any way master the language. So you can easily imagine that the ordinary people are not at all able to do it, that only those who can go on learning up to a great age can at last become proficient. In China, therefore, noble rank is conferred as a matter of course on those who are cultured, and this high rank arises through the nature of the language and script. Here, again, it is not the same as in the West, where various degrees of nobility can be conferred, and then passes on from one generation to another. In China, rank can be attained only through education and scholarship. It is interesting, gentlemen, is it not, that if we judge superficially, we would surely say, quote, in that case, we don't want to be Chinese, close quote. But please don't assume that I am saying we ought to become Chinese or even particularly to admire China. That is what some people may easily say about it. 2 years ago, when we had a congress in Vienna, someone spoke of how some things in China were managed, even today, more wisely than we manage them. And immediately the newspapers reported that we wanted Chinese culture in Europe. That is not what was meant. In describing the ancient Chinese culture, praise must be given in a certain way, but only in a certain way, for what it had of spiritual content. But it was a primitive culture, of a kind that can no longer be adopted by us. So you must not think I am agitating to establish another China in Europe. I simply wish to describe this most ancient of human cultures as it actually existed. Let us go on. What I have been saying is related to the whole manner of Chinese thinking and feeling. Indeed, the Chinese and also the Japanese of more ancient times occupied themselves a great deal, a very great deal, with art, with their kind of art. They painted, for instance. Now, when we paint, it is quite a different affair from Chinese painting. You see, when we paint, I will make this as simple as possible, when we paint a ball, for example, if the light falls on it, then the ball is bright in one part and dark in another, for it is in shadow. The light does not fall on it. There again, on the light side, the ball is rather bright because there the light is reflected. Then we say that side is in shadow, for the light is reflected on the other side, and we also have to paint the shadow the ball throws on the ground. This is one of the characteristics of our painting. We must have light and shade on objects. When we paint a face, we paint it bright where the light falls, and on the other side we make it dark. When we paint a whole person, if we paint properly, we put shadow in the same way falling across the ground. But beside this, we must pay attention to something else in our picture. Suppose I am standing here and want to paint. I see Herr Eisenpreis sitting in front. There behind I see Herr Meyer, and the two gentlemen at the back quite small. Were I to photograph them, they would also appear quite small. When I paint in such a way that the gentlemen sitting in the front row are quite big, the next behind smaller, the next again still smaller, and the one sitting right at the back has a really small head, a really small face. You see, when we paint, we take perspective into account. We have to do it that way. We have to show light and shade and also perspective. This is inherent in the way we think. Now, the Chinese in their painting did not recognize light and shade, nor did they allow for perspective, because they did not see as we see. They took no notice of light and shade and no notice of perspective. This is what they would have said. Quote, Eisenpreis is certainly not a giant, any more than Meyer is a dwarf. We can't put them together in a picture as if one were a giant and the other a dwarf, for that would be a lie. It is not the truth. Close quote. That's the way they thought about things, and they painted as they thought. When the Chinese and the Japanese learn painting in their way, they do not look at objects from the outside. They think themselves right into the objects. They paint everything from within outward, as they imagine things for themselves. This, gentlemen, constitutes the very nature of Chinese and Japanese painting. You will realize, therefore, that learning to see came only later to mankind. Human beings in that early China thought only in pictures. They did not form general concepts like table and so on, but what they saw they apprehended inwardly. This is not to be wondered at, for the Chinese descended from a culture where seeing was different. Today we see as we do because there is air between us and the object. This air was simply not there in the regions where the Chinese first became established. In the times from which the Chinese descended, people did not see in our way. In those ancient times, it would have been nonsense to speak of light and shade, for there was not yet any such thing in the density the air then had. And so the Chinese still have no light and shade in their painting and still no perspective. That came only later. From this you can see the Chinese think in quite a different way. They do not think as people do who came later. However, this did not in the least hinder the Chinese from developing great skills and intelligence applied to the external world. When I was young, it is rather different now, we learned in school that Berthold Schwarz invented gunpowder, and this was told us as if there had never been gunpowder before. So Berthold Schwarz, while he was doing alchemistic experiments, produced gunpowder out of sulfur, nitre, and carbon. But the Chinese had made gunpowder thousands of years earlier. Also, we learned in school that Gutenberg invented the art of printing. We did learn many things that were correct, but in this case, we were led to believe that there had formerly been no knowledge of printing. Actually, the Chinese already possessed this knowledge thousands of years earlier. They also had the art of wood carving. They could cut the most wonderful things out of wood. In such external things, the Chinese had an advanced culture. This was, in its turn, the last remnant of a former culture, still more advanced, for one recognizes that this Chinese art goes back to something even higher. Thus it is characteristic of the Chinese to think not in concepts, but in pictures, and to project themselves right into things. They have been able to make all those things which depend upon practical invention, except when it's a matter of steam engines or something similar. So the present, somewhat degenerate condition of the Chinese has actually come about from centuries of ill-treatment at the hands of the Europeans. You see that there is a culture that is really spiritual in a certain sense, and really ancient, that goes back to 10,000 years before our time. Much later, in the millennium preceding Christianity, individuals like Lao Tse and Confucius made the first written record of the knowledge possessed by the Chinese. Those masters simply wrote down what had developed as knowledge within this old kingdom's family structure. They were not conscious of inventing rules of a moral or ethical nature. They were simply recording their experience of Chinese conduct. Previously, this had been done by word of mouth. Thus, everything at that time was basically different. That is what can still be perceived today in the Chinese. It is hardly possible to see this any longer in the old culture of the Japanese people, because they have been entirely Europeanized. They follow European culture in everything. That they did not develop this culture out of themselves can be seen from their inability to discover, on their own initiative, what is purely European. The following, for example, really happened. The Japanese were to have steamships, and saw no reason why they should not be able to manage them perfectly well themselves. They watched how to turn the ship, for instance, how to open the screw, and so on. Their instructors, the Europeans, worked with them for a time, and finally one day the Japanese said proudly, quote, "Now we can manage by ourselves, and we will appoint our own captain," close quote. So the European instructors were put ashore and off steamed the Japanese to the high seas. When they were ready to turn back, they turned the screw, and the ship turned round beautifully. But no one knew how to close the screw, and there was the ship whirling round and round on the sea, just turning and turning. The European instructors, watching from the shore, had to take a boat and bring the revolving ship to a standstill. Perhaps you remember Goethe's poem titled The Magician's Apprentice, where the apprentice watches the spells of the old master magician, and then, to save himself the trouble of fetching water, he learns a magic verse by which he will be able to make a broom into a water carrier. One day, when the old magician is out, the apprentice begins to put this magic into practice and recites the words to start the broom working. The broom really gets down to business and fetches water and more water and always more water, but the apprentice forgets how to stop it. Just imagine if you had your room flooded and your broom went on fetching more and more water. In his desperation, the apprentice chops the broom in two. Then there are two water carriers. When everything is drowned in water, the old master returns and says the right words for the broom to become a broom again. As you know, the poem has been done in Eurythmy recently, and the audience enjoyed it immensely. Well, the same kind of thing happened with the Japanese. They didn't know how to turn back the screw, and so the ship continued to go round and round. A regular ship's dance went on out there until the instructors on land could get a boat and come to the rescue. Surely it is clear from all this that the European sort of invention is impossible for either the Chinese or the Japanese. But as to older inventions, such as gunpowder, printing, and so forth, they had already gone that far in much more ancient times than the Europeans. You see, the Chinese are much more interested in their whole environment, in the world of the stars, in the universe as a whole. Another people who point back to ancient days are the Indians. They do not go so far back as the Chinese, but they, too, have an old culture. Their culture may be said to have arisen from the sea later than the Chinese. The people who were the later Indian people came more from the north, settling down in what is now India as the land became free of water. Now, whereas the Chinese were more interested in the world outside them, could project themselves into anything, the Indian people brooded more within themselves. The Chinese reflected more about the world, in their own way, but about the world. The Indians reflected chiefly about themselves, about man himself. Hence the culture that arose in India was more spiritualized. In the most remote times, Indian culture was still free of religion. Only later did religion enter into it. Man was their principal object of study, but their study was of an inward kind. This, too, I can best make clear by describing the way the Indians used to draw and paint. The Chinese, looking at a human being, painted him simply by entering into him with their thinking, without light and shade or perspective. That is really the way they painted him. Thus, if a Chinese had wanted to paint Herr Berle, he would have thought his way into him. He would not have made him dark there and light here, as we would do today. He would not have painted light and shadow, for they did not yet exist for the Chinese. Nor would he have made the hands bigger by comparison, because of their being in front. But if the Chinese had painted Herr Berle, then Herr Berle would really have been there in the picture. It was quite different with the Indians. When Indians were going to paint a picture, they would start by painting a head. They too had no such thing as perspective. But they would at once have had the idea that a head could often be different. So they would make another, then a third, again different, and a fourth, a fifth would have occurred to them. In this way, they would gradually have had 20 or 30 heads side by side. These would all have been suggested to them by the one head. Or if they were painting a plant, they imagined at once that this could be different, and then there arose a number of young plants growing out of the older one. This is how it was in the case of the Indians in those very ancient times. They had tremendous powers of imagination. The Chinese had none at all, and drew only the single thing, but made their way into this in thought. The Indians had a powerful imagination. Now, you see, gentlemen, those heads are not there. Really, if you look at Herr Berle, you see only one head. If you're drawing him here on the board, you can draw only one head. You are therefore not painting what is outwardly real if you paint 20 or 30 heads. You are painting something conceived in your mind. The whole Indian culture took on that character. It was an inner culture of the mind, of the spirit. Hence, when you see spiritual beings, as the Indians thought of them, you see them represented with numbers of heads, numbers of arms, or in such a way that the animal nature of the body is made manifest. You see, the Indians are quite different people from the Chinese. The Chinese lack imagination, whereas the Indians have been full of it from the beginning. Hence the Indians were predisposed to turn their culture gradually into a religious one, which up to this day the Chinese have never done. There is no religion as such in China. Europeans, who are not given to making fine distinctions, speak of a Chinese religion, but the Chinese themselves do not acknowledge such a thing. They say, "You people in Europe have a religion, the Indians have a religion, but we have nothing resembling a religion." This predisposition to religion was possible in the Indians only because they had a particular knowledge of something of which the Chinese were ignorant, namely of the human body. The Chinese knew very well how to enter into something external to them. When there are vinegar, salt, and pepper on our dinner table, and we want to know how they taste, we first have to sample them on our tongue. For the Chinese in ancient times, this was not necessary. They already tasted things that were still outside them. They could really feel their way into things and were quite familiar with what was external. Hence they had certain expressions showing that they took part in the outside world. We no longer have such expressions, or they signify at most something of a figurative nature. For the Chinese, they signified reality. When I am getting to know someone and say to him, quote, "What a sour fellow he is," close quote, I mean it figuratively. We do not imagine him to be really sour, as vinegar is sour. But for the Chinese, this meant that the person actually evoked in them a sour taste. It was not so with the Indians. They could go much more deeply into their own bodies. If we go deeply into our own bodies, we can feel something there under certain conditions. Whenever we've had a meal and it remains in our stomach without being properly digested, we feel pain in our stomach. If our liver is out of order and cannot secrete sufficient bile, we feel pain on the right side of our body. Then we are getting a liver complaint. When our lungs secrete too freely, so that they are more full of mucus than they should be, then we feel there is something wrong with our lungs, that they are out of order. Today, human beings are conscious of their bodies only in those organs that are sick. Those Indians of ancient times were conscious even of their healthy organs. They knew how the stomach, how the liver felt. When anyone wants to know this today, he has to take a corpse and dissect it. Then he can examine the condition of the individual organs inside. No one today knows what a liver looks like unless they dissect it. It is only spiritual science that is able to describe it. The Indians could think of the interior of the human being. They would have been able to draw all his organs. With an Indian, however, if you had asked him to sense his liver and draw what he felt, he would have said, quote, liver? Well, here is one liver, here's another, and here's another. And he would have drawn 20 or 30 livers side by side. So, gentlemen, you have there a different story. If I draw a complete person and give him 20 heads, I have a fanciful picture. But if I draw a human liver with 20 or 30 others beside it, I am drawing something not wholly fantastic. It would have been possible for these 20 or 30 livers really to have existed. Every person has his distinctive form of liver, but there is no absolute necessity for that form. It could very well be different. This possibility of difference, this spiritual aspect of the matter, was far better understood by the Indians than by those who came later. The Indian said, quote, when we draw a single object, it is not the whole truth. We have to conceive the matter spiritually, close quote. So the Indians have had a lofty spiritual culture. They have never set great store by the outer world, but have had a spiritual conception of everything. Now the Indians took it for granted that learning should be acquired in accordance with this attitude. Therefore, to become an educated person was a lengthy affair. For as you can imagine, with them, it was not just a matter of going deeply into oneself and then being capable of knowing everything immediately. When we are responsible for the instruction of young people, we have first to teach them to read and write, imparting to them in this way something from outside. But this was not so in the case of the ancient Indians. When they wanted to teach someone, they showed him how to withdraw into his inner depths. He was to turn his attention away from the world entirely, and to focus it upon his inner being. Now, if anyone sits and looks outward, he sees you all sitting there, and his attention is directed to the outer world. This would have been the way with the Chinese. They directed their attention outward. The Indians taught otherwise. They said, quote, you must learn to gaze at the tip of your nose, close quote. Then the student had to keep his eyes fixed so that he saw nothing but the tip of his nose, nothing else for hours at a time, without even moving his eyes. Yes, indeed, gentlemen, the European may think it terrible to train people to continually contemplate the tip of their nose. True. For the European, there is something terrible in it. It would be impossible for him to do such a thing. But in ancient India, that was the custom. In order to learn anything, an Indian did not have to write with his fingers. He had to look at the tip of his nose. For this, sitting for hours gazing at the tip of his nose led him into his own inner being, led him to know his lungs, his liver, and so forth. For the tip of the nose is the same in the second hour as it is in the first. Nothing special is to be seen there. From the tip of his nose, however, the student was able to behold more and more of what was within him. Within him everything became brighter and brighter. That is why he had to carry out the exercise. Now, as you know, when we walk about, we are accustomed to do so on our feet, and this going about on our feet has an effect upon us. We experience ourselves as upright human beings when we walk on our feet. This was discouraged for students in India. While learning, they had to have one leg like this and sit on it, while the other leg was in this position. Thus they sat, gazing fixedly at the tip of their nose, so that they became quite unused to standing. They had the feeling they were not upright, but shrunk like an embryo in a mother's womb. You can see the Buddha portrayed in this way. It was thus that the Indians had to learn. Gradually, they began to look within themselves, learned to know what is within man, came to have knowledge of the human physical body in an entirely spiritual way. When we look within ourselves, we are conscious of our paltry thinking. We are slightly aware of our feeling. but almost not at all of our willing. The Indians felt a whole world in the human being. You can imagine what different people they were from those who came later. They developed, as you know, a tremendous imagination, expressed poetically in their books of wisdom. Later in the Vedas and in the Vedantic philosophy, which still fill us with awe. It figured in their legends concerning supersensible things, which still amaze us today. And look at the contrast. Here were the Indians on the one hand, and there were the Chinese on the other. And the Chinese were a prosaic people, interested in the outer world, a people who did not live from within. The Indians were a people who looked entirely inward, contemplating within them the spiritual nature of the physical body. So, I have begun to tell you about the most ancient inhabitants of the earth. Next time I will continue, right up to the time we live in now. Please continue to bring your questions. There may be details that you would like me to enlarge upon, and I can always, at some subsequent meeting, answer the questions you have raised. But I can't tell you when the next session will be, because now I must go to Holland. I will send you word in 10 days or so. The end of discussion 5.